It is my great pleasure to welcome Joseph Rowe to Many Rivers Books and Tea to speak about reimagining early Christians and Gnostics. Joseph Rowe is a storyteller, musician, as you see. This is some of the music, I believe, performed by himself and his partner, Catherine Bozlovsky, and presume possibly others. I don't really know who's on this CD. But also a teacher, musical therapist, and writer who has the good fortune to live in Paris. Sevastopol or Paris. Two possibilities of places to live. And Mr. Rowe has Paris. The rest of us, Sevastopol.
Almost as good.
Almost as good. Maybe even better in some ways. But
less stress.
Less stress, no doubt about that. He's a translator of a number of books, and we have these books here, and they are some very interesting books that you can see arrayed on this table before you. Mostly on the Christian and Gnostic alternative texts and gospels. And that is, of course, some of the subject matter he'll be speaking about tonight, but some other topics as well. So we're delighted to welcome Mr. Rowe to the stage here at Many Rivers. Welcome, and thank you for coming.
Could I ask first, how many, I noticed a number of people were also at the talk at the church. How many were not at the talk at the church? Okay, good. Okay. I wanted to cover somewhat different subjects, but it's okay if I overlap quite a bit too. Okay, good. The music you just heard is a composition written by my collaborator and partner, significant other, Catherine Bozlovsky, was here. It's called Sana Notes. From an album called Chartres, and it was recorded in the Cathedral of Chartres. She's one of the few composers I know of today who actually writes words, as well as writing music. She writes the lyrics in Latin, sometimes, not very often. she and I are searching for, have been for a long time, what I, in my own way, am searching for is a music, sacred music, a sense of sacred performance of today, which is really of our times, and yet which has roots in antiquity, and especially in that antiquity in which all the performing arts were sacred. Many of you might know that recent research of the last 30 years especially has demonstrated very convincingly that shamanism is the origin of all the performing arts. If you go back far enough to nomadic, prehistoric, Paleolithic times, certainly, Neolithic, that all of the performing arts find their roots in shamanic practices. Later on, they became more sophisticated and with cities and more complexity, they became a diversion. But the original roots are sacred. And we're lacking that today in the performing arts, that sense of the sacred. I've spent, I just calculated before I came here, a third of my life in Paris. I'm an American rooted in both my country here and now in new roots in France. And maybe I could talk a little bit about that on a personal level. Because what I wanted to talk about tonight is, as well as the reimagining the early Gnostics, is the transpersonal psychology, what Gnosticism can teach us and help us to in the realm of transpersonal psychology. But whenever you talk about the transpersonal, I think it's wise to begin and to include certainly the personal. So this is my transpersonal approach. It's my own approach to Gnosticism, and I believe it ends up as being more objective that way. When a long time ago, when I was in university, I worked in newspaper collections, and I read a lot of old American newspapers from 1800s, and I was amazed at how even when they were reporting simple events, you know, they said, "I felt this, I saw this, in my opinion, this." They were very opinionated about the events they were reporting, but it wound up being a lot more honest than today's pretense of objectivity, in which the reporter, the journalist, gets to hide their own biases behind this stance of objectivity. And so that really influenced me a lot to be that way without, at the same time, you know, without getting lost in the personal either. And so I live in France. My roots are in America. We're talking about Sebastopol, and you might, some of you might envy me for living in Paris, and with good reason. It's a wonderful. It's one of the, as big cities go, it's hard to beat it. But Sebastopol, I envy you also, living in Sebastopol. And France and America, they're so complementary in a lot of ways. You know, about religion. I often tell American friends of mine that in America we have this really serious problem of fundamentalist Christianity. Militant, aggressive, proselytizing, very politicized fundamentalist Christianity is a huge problem in our culture. In France, we have the problem, believe it or not, and I'm not joking, it's really serious, of fundamentalist rationalism, which is quite militant in it also in its own way. And there's right now a thing in France called Miviludes, which is a blacklist. It's semi-official. You don't get to know whether it's really governmental or whether it's just with governmental approval. It's a blacklist of cults, in fact, of dangerous cults. And it's really a mechanism of repression and persecution of any kind of new religion, any kind of new... Well, not just religion, anything that has a spiritual quality about it at all. Not just religions. And ironically, it's a secret thing. You know, politics make strange bedfellows. You know? This is, I believe, at least, I don't have any proof of this, but I think it's a case of the collusion of the militant rationalists, militant atheists, and secularists who were very powerful in French culture with the right-wing Catholic Church
to get rid of all the competition.
Yeah, so that nothing new can happen in that realm.
What's an example of something that would be
of a repression?
Blacklisted.
Yeah, very recently, some good friends of ours who have a wonderful organization called Terre du Ciel, which is a totally ecumenical, broad-based organization which brings together people from very different religions, and not just religions, but psychologists, ecologists, for, you know, talking about new visions of social change and so on. They were raided by this organization. Their computers were confiscated. There was no due process at all, they finally got out of it. I think largely because have you heard of Juliette Binoche?
Mm-hmm.
She's good friends with them and often appears in their programs. So I think maybe she used her influence. They have friends in high places, thank God. I don't know what would have happened otherwise. The anthroposophists were persecuted, and they took it to court and won.
What about more traditional established religions that are not Christian? Like, there's a lot of different Buddhist teachers coming.
That's okay.
They're okay.
Yeah, that's okay. If it's established, it's okay. The ones they go after are new things. People who are better. Oh, yes. Amma. Have you heard of Amma? Yeah, they raided her and shut it down temporarily. Yeah. It's really different cultures. France and the U.S. have a lot to learn from each other. I think you have many of you heard of Harold Bloom, not Howard, but Harold Bloom, who writes about Gnosticism. I don't agree with a lot of what he says about Gnosticism, but he's certainly a good writer. And he said one thing that I really found quite interesting. He said America is profoundly in its soul and in what it really has to offer to the world, a Gnostic country. Mm-hmm. But he said, however, it's dominated, and it has been historically for a long time, by the Old Testament, and it seems not to have really discovered the New Testament. it reminds me of a comment by Chesterton, I think it was, who said, "It's not that Christianity has failed; it's that it's never been tried." he said, he thought there is something old about the Christianity in the U.S. It's really more Old Testament. France? Now, this is really paradoxical. To me, France is a New Testament country, although it's non-believer. Most people are total non-believers, but they're somehow in the institutions and in the attitude, it's deeply Christian and deeply compassionate, at least. For example, the healthcare system, which is wonderful. I believe it's been rated as the world's best healthcare system, at least for allopathic medicine. And the healthcare system, the general social support, there's a lot more compassion there. There's a lot more putting in practice of the teachings of Jesus. A friend of mine asked me once, who's I studied Buddhism. I studied and practiced Buddhism for a long time, and I'm kind of rediscovering Christianity. I have been for the last 10, 15 years. And she asked me an interesting question. I think you were there. It was at dinner. She said, speaking from a Buddhist standpoint and from a kind of a universal ecumenical standpoint, what is it about Christians that makes them think they're so special? Yeah. And what, is there really anything? Is it just collective egotism and imperialism, or is there anything special about Christianity? Because when you take the teachings of Jesus, and I thought about that for a long time, and my first response was to say, no, not really. It's all, but there is actually something special, I believe, about Christianity that's rare in other great religions, and that's the teaching of the need for social change. You find it in the teachings of Jesus. You don't find it in the teachings of the Buddha. You don't find it as far as very much in Islam or any of the, or certainly not Hinduism, or any of the other great religions. You don't find that, say, or even in Judaism, which is, you find something closer to it. But there is this kind of teaching of the need for changing the world. That's dangerous at the same time. It's a dangerous teaching because it can easily become fanaticism. So that's... I guess I'd like to start by reading a little bit from some notes, if you don't mind. I want to do a more free-flowing talk and have some... a good exchange and improvisation and so on, but I'm kind of like a musician who reads music, reads scores, but really likes to improvise. And right now I need to read the score a little bit, so I'll just read a little bit from what I've prepared here. A value common to both transpersonal psychology and Gnostic traditions of about 2,000 years ago is the authority given to individual visionary experience. That's something we kind of take for granted now, but in those times it was not at all taken for granted. It was, especially in the Abrahamic religions, you receive divine truth through intermediaries, either through the intermediary of a priest or a rabbi or whatever, or through the intermediary of a sacred text. You don't have the direct experience is something rather suspect. It's not that way now. It's funny. We've come to a point where that's no longer revolutionary to say to talk about that. But those suppressed currents of our Western Christian heritage were driven underground by the marriage between Roman power and the Christian orthodoxies. And I don't know if a lot of you realize that a lot of people, in fact, who biblical scholars and New Testament scholars don't seem to realize even that Christianity, there was no such thing as a Christian mainstream in the beginning for at least two centuries, certainly a century, century and a half. There was no mainstream. Christianity was incredibly diverse. And there were many more than four Gospels. What happened? Suppression. And especially suppression of this Gnostic strain of highly valuing individual mystical or visionary experience. I should define really what I mean now by Gnosticism, because I don't use it in the same way that a lot of writers do. Let's talk about the roots of the word Gnosis. By the way, I'm speaking as a scholarly storyteller and a musician and teacher. Rather than as a scholar, I've studied a little Greek and Arabic and these other languages, but I'm a scholarly storyteller rather than a scholar. But I'm confident about this, though. Gnosis in Greek means something a lot deeper than knowledge. If you look in a Greek dictionary or something, it'll tell you it means knowledge, but it's kind of like logos. It's really much deeper than that. And we'll get into that in a minute. Does everyone know about the Indo-European family of languages? In most of the Indo-European languages, you see this root. In Sanskrit, it's jnana, or jnana is the in modern pronunciation. For example, Latin cognoscere, things in French, it's connaissance in French, kennen in German, knowledge in English. It's something much older than the schools called the Gnostic schools. A lot of people, when they talk about the Gnosticism, they're really talking about a certain kind of Gnostic, doctrine, which flourished in Alexandria, especially just before the birth of Jesus up to about the 3rd century when they began to be stamped out by the new Roman Christian power. These Gnostics are really for example, who had doctrines like the fall of Sophia, the demiurge, they were very often dualistic. The reason I don't like to capitalize Gnostic at all, and I like to use the term Gnosis and Gnosticism in a much more universal sense, is because it's sort of like as if you were to capitalize the mystics, talk about the mystics, and say that with a capital M, the mystics believe this. And when you're really talking about a certain school of mystics, and it's highly confusing when you start to do that. So when I say the Gnostics, I mean something much more inclusive. It includes these guys who talk about Barbello, the fall of Sophia, and these other curious and fascinating doctrines, mythology, I might say. But it's much older than that, much, much older. It's some, Aubrey Caldwell, I use it in his term. He's a tremendous influence on me. He's one of my great teachers through books. Aubrey Caldwell.
I think it's with an I.
Henri is
in French.
No, it's with an I. Yeah. Exception. Yeah. Remember it would be. And my French ID card is Joseph Henri with an I. He thought it should be an I. Mm-hmm. But actually, he was a Frenchman, but it was. It's a lie. There's a book which I translated, actually, which I highly recommend by him, not published by Inner Traditions, but by North Atlantic, called The Voyage and the Messenger, by Ulrich Caldwell, a beautiful book. He talks about Gnostics in this more universal sense. And I'll just read a little quote from him about this. These Gnostics, in the universal sense, were very widespread. They weren't just in Alexandria or the Middle East or the Roman world or anything like that. They were all the way through India, China, and he says, "I can just find this." Sorry. He says, furthermore, when two Gnostics met, even from very different cultures and religions, they usually recognized each other, often immediately and intuitively, with little need for words and less need for reference to common beliefs. According to some etymologies, the word Zen, or Chan, comes from the same root, Jnana. Although that's contested, not everybody agrees. But I kind of like that etymology, that, even, that Zen also comes from that. It's a kind of, it's a knowing which accepts not knowing. It's a knowledge which goes beyond the intellect, and yet which includes the intellect. You might say, what's the difference between a Gnostic and a mystic? That's a good question. To me, the difference between a Gnostic and a mystic is the inclusion of the intellect and of language and of the effort to speak the divine, even though it's hopeless, and accepting that hopelessness and accepting that it's impossible, and yet trying to anyway. That's what differentiates a Gnostic from a mystic to me. Also, maybe it's a question of temperament too. You might know that in Hinduism there are three, or probably more, but in one school there's three temperaments. The Gnostic temperament, or Jnana, is one temperament in which is the approach to divine truth, to self-realization through Jnana, through Gnosis. Knowledge, using the intellect to go beyond the intellect. There's bhakti, which is devotion. And then there's karma, which is good works and work on oneself. And of course, we need all three. You know, that's not. what by temperament we tend to find our home base in one of those three. And so that might be another difference between Gnostics in this universal sense. In our own Western culture, we have a really special situation of ruthless suppression. About 2,000 years ago, a little less, say 1,700 years ago, of our own Gnostic tradition, and it's you might know that Jung was fascinated by this, and he believed that this suppressed Gnostic current in our culture resurfaced in the form of alchemy. You know, James Hillman. Have you all heard of James Hillman? It's another Gnostic, in my sense, that I really admire a lot and have learned a lot from. James Hillman says, see if I can quote this right. If you were born and raised in the West, in Western, any Western culture, then no matter what your beliefs are, psychologically, you're a Christian. Now that's really very profound. And that gets back to what I was talking about Christianity, Judeo-Christianity being something which addresses social change and the need for social change in a way that other religions don't. Living in a country like France, which is militantly, since the French Revolution, you know, and for a lot of good reasons, puts a high value on laïcité, how do you say laïcité, on secularism, secular values, and the separation of church and state, and so on, as we did in our constitution also, or theoretically at least. In French culture, I think I lost my train there.
The value of church and state.
Yeah, the separation of church and state is it's an issue which has maybe, in a sense, gone too far, and which that you can't even talk about the sacred in a secular context. Book. I don't know if that book is here or not. As in the Heart, So in the Earth, by Pierre Rabhi. Pierre is a wonderful person. He's an agroecologist. In fact, he founded the whole field of agroecology. He's also a Gnostic, at least in my sense. I don't know if he would call himself that. He says that the absence of any sense of the sacred from politics is, and especially from green politics, is a terrible lack. And it's something, you see, green parties are never going to succeed as long as they go along with this taboo against talking about just the sacredness of the earth.
How do you address the influence of Calvinism in the United States? It really kind of veered in another path of everything's predestined. People were judged by that you could know if you were successful, then you were one of those people who were going to go to heaven because you were blessings, and those who had less successful lives probably weren't going to. I've read books that it really fundamentally changed the nature of religion in the United States.
That's an interesting question. But could you remind me of that a little later? I want to cover some other subjects first, and then we'll get back to that. Okay, that's a good question. It's about Puritanism also. In our current crisis of evolution, going back to my score here, my written score. We're facing challenges which are, in some respects, the opposite of those that the ancient Gnostics faced. Pluralism and individualism that often degenerates into social fragmentation and narcissism. Our great need now is for a sharing of transpersonal experiences which can be integrated into everyday life in a pluralistic society. Because it's, in a way, we've won the battle for individual expression, for the respect for individual religious experience. We're no longer fighting that battle. But we've gone to the kind of in a curious way to another extreme of fragmentation and of the lack of collective intelligence and of people taking refuge in separate groups with their own collective egos and so on. I believe that this can begin very simply by recognizing the ritual nature of things that we already do, like in our language games, and their often unnoticed musical quality. And a little while we'll look at some Gnostic texts and their musical quality and their and think about how we can not only reimagine those early Gnostics speaking these texts, chanting them, and changing their state of consciousness through these texts, but imagine that we might have something in our own heritage, very precious, that could help us without necessarily saying I am a Christian in the usual sense of the word, but in the psychological sense that Hillman was talking about. Oh, I remember the thread that I forgot was that something Catherine and I have really noticed, kind of an insight we've come to over the years, living in a society where Marxism, Leninism, is a really powerful force in French society, for example, the Communist Party is not this thing with fangs and horns. It's just another political party, of the left, and along with the socialists and the others. Socialism is a dirty word here too, but communism is a diabolical word. There, it's not at all. It's a profound influence. Marxism and Marx himself, his teachings are a deep influence in French and European society in general. And the insight is that someone like Marx, who in spite of all the things about him that I personally don't like, for example, his rigid materialism, philosophical materialism and so on, this sense of economic justice and social justice is something that could only have arisen in a Judeo-Christian context. I really believe that. And it's of course spread like wildfire over the whole planet. Virus, in a very immature and kind of tyrannical form, granted, it's something that's profoundly compatible. And you've probably heard people say this before with the early Christians, and that's where Marx got his ideas, his ideals from, at least. Consciously or unconsciously, I believe. Actually, if you read the teachings of Hillel, they have a lot of the same kinds of teachings about that you'll find in teachings of Jesus about sharing, about the poor and the despised being respected, and the social status, something overcoming social status and power. Now on to this question. You might wonder why I keep going back to a remote antiquity, much older than the Gnostics who flourished in Alexandria. It's really because this sense of Gnosticism is really includes but is not limited to what people usually speak of as Eastern mysticism. This is our, it's reclaiming our Western, our lost Western mystical tradition. That's what it is. And now let's talk about maybe some different kinds of Gnosticism that flourished, those ones I was talking about, the dualistic Gnostics. Well, that word dualistic is really a problematical word. It's very easy to say non-dualism and to say, I'm a non-dualist. As soon as you say that, have you ever noticed that as soon as you say that, you set up a kind of dualism. the dualist versus the non-dualist. Our language itself is dualistic. And this kind of gnosis takes that into account and accepts the paradox, accepts the really deep paradox that we can't say the best things, as Joseph Campbell said, another of my great teachers, the best things can't be said, but we have to try to say them and to accept that paradox fully. Another paradox that I believe Gnosis helps us to accept is the paradox of the psychological paradox. Psychological and philosophical. And this gets into the non-dualistic, the dualistic, this gets into the dualistic Gnostics, that there's something wrong with this world. There's something really wrong, and not just with one social order or a better social order, but something wrong with this. Even some of them went so far as to say something wrong with this universe, with this physical universe. These were the Gnostics who believed in the demiurge. Have you heard that term, demiurge? I'll write it. Demiurgos in Greek. That's a term they took from Plato, and of course the Gnostics, as all philosophers and other people in Alexandria, this incredible, wonderful ferment of Alexandria, they were deeply influenced by Plato. And what is the demiurge? Is a kind of an artificer or artisan god, a very high, very powerful being who, this is according to them, not me, but according to them, made this physical universe, created this physical universe. And that it is not the source, it is not the ultimate source, it is not the highest divinity at all. It is an artisan kind of divinity. And he was a real bungler and somewhat of an egotist, too. He had like a giant ego. And, even more shocking, this really shocked Jews and Christians at the time, he was the Yahweh, the Jehovah of the Old Testament, in fact, was this not very nice God. And of course, you can find plenty of places in the Bible to justify that, a jealous God that does some pretty terrible things. By the way, just as an aside, I guess all of you are familiar with the notion of redactions, right? Editing. The sacred texts have been edited, right? That's another amazing thing that we now are widely accepting in our time. It was not accepted in, a few centuries ago. All sacred texts of just about any religion have been edited, gone through a lot of editions.
Have they found any that are actually the originals, or that they could say this is the original, or is that?
Yes, but that's a complex, really complex story. But yes, if you wrote a good book is Who Wrote the Bible, mm-hmm. by what's his name? Forgot his name. I guess I'll on our website there's a bibliography. If you click on Scripture, on that website, you'll find and explore the various pages there. Not that many. You'll find a bibliography with that book, and also Who Wrote the New Testament by Burton Mack is another good one. Both of those books are written from a very secularist perspective. The authors don't tell you anything about how they feel, what they believe, and that's typical of America in biblical scholarship, is that very few biblical scholars in America will... even Elaine Pagels. Have all of you heard of Elaine Pagels?
Oh, yeah.
The preeminent scholar on Gnosticism. I believe the world's... probably the top scholar, living scholar on Gnosticism, Elaine Pagels. But she is very hesitant to get her feet wet and tell you how this affects her life and what she really believes. Jean-Yves Leloup is a real exception to that. I don't know of anyone quite like him in America, who's both a biblical scholar and, as it happens, an Orthodox priest, but very ecumenical and pluralistic.
Mm-hmm. You spoke of the belief, the dualist belief, that there might be something wrong with this world or universe. And what about the origin of the dualistic belief that there's something inherently also wrong with people?
I'm very glad you asked that, because that's I was about to lose that thread. Well, that's not so much them. They didn't talk very much about that themselves. But this gnosis, I believe, can help us with that. We face that same paradox, and our sense that there's something wrong with the world, or our sense that there's something wrong with me. Mm. The paradox of that is that about something wrong with the world, as one of the best statements of that paradox I've heard is by Ram Dass, who said somehow as human beings we have to face two completely contradictory things. One is that there's an experience of absolute perfection, that all that is, just as it is absolutely perfect, mind-bogglingly perfect and beautiful beyond description. And at the same time, there are beings who are suffering, and we have to try to make it better. And so it's perfect, but we have to try to make it better. And so the intellect can't really solve that paradox. And there's the same kind of thing occurs in individual psychology, is that there's a sense of wrongness with me. I look at my life. I look at my blind habits, my bad habits, my profound bad habits, I see that there's something wrong. But in order to change, if I stay in that sense of wrongness, it disempowers me from change, actually, and it sort of puts this ego in charge of doing the change, which already is an expression of that of his bad habits.
The Course in Miracles would agree, right, in the sense that it says that there is something really wrong with this world. God didn't create it, and it was a murderous thought of mm-hmm. separation
yeah.
that's created this world. There's nothing wrong with us except that we believe in guilt and sin. And so the Course in Miracles, what it does is it takes the nightmare of, it's a dream, but it's a nightmare,
And slowly the nightmare of suffering, you know, becomes a good dream, a happy dream, and that then leads to waking up out of the dream,
mm-hmm.
which is what this...
That's a very Gnostic, it's a profoundly Gnostic teaching. And in fact, it's a good evidence for what Harold Bloom's contention that America is a profoundly Gnostic country, because that channeled material that mm-hmm. the Course in Miracles happened in America, where else could, according to him, it's quite logical that it would come here. And I would say from what I know of the Course in Miracles that it's a non-dualistic mm-hmm. Form of Gnosticism, but it does retain that sense, it grapples with that sense of wrongness, as you just call it, the nightmare. Maybe we could open it up for discussion. Now, you wanted to talk about Puritanism?
But
who was it?
Calvinism.
Sorry,
Calvinism. It seems to me it took the influence from a rich inner spiritual life to emphasis on materialism and outer trappings.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they're so prevalent in our Western society.
To me, that's having lived in France has taught me how profoundly puritanical the U.S. Is, including people who would deny that there is anything Puritan about them, who think they're liberated and so on. But when it comes to whether of the left or of the right, or in between, or ecologists, there's a thing of. I don't know how to describe it. And sexuality, for example, American feminism tends to be, I believe that's really changing now, but it tends to be quite puritanical compared to French feminism. Here's just an anecdote, that years ago I was watching a tennis game on TV, and I can't remember her name, a famous German tennis player, I was young and beautiful, and the commentator said, and there you have the most beautiful pair of legs in tennis. And I realized that an American commentator wouldn't dare say that. I believe. That's the Puritan strain is strong in our country. Yeah, that's very strong. Calvinism is one aspect. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. So I'm just learning about Gnosticism.
Mm-hmm.
So I was wondering if you could talk a little bit more about the Gnostic Gospels and it's a little bit more about its roots and its history.
Sure.
And the belief system and mm-hmm. the variety of sects, it sounds like,
mm-hmm.
or the divisions in Gnosticism.
They're within the Gnostics.
Yeah.
That's right. These Gospels... here, the most universal Gnostic gospel, and that's really Gnostic in the most universal sense, is the Gospel of Thomas. There's no Gnostic with a capital G doctrine at all. It's a very pure, very profound. It's my favorite of all the gospels, including the canonical gospels. There's an anecdote, which I think I said at the church, but I don't mind repeating. This well-known Buddhist, American Buddhist teacher, Richard Baker Roshi, said, if I had read the Gospel of Thomas when I was young, I wouldn't have become a Buddhist.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the most universal. Then a little bit more Gnostic in the sense of you're getting into some of this doctrine doctrine is kind of a pejorative word. You get in more of these kind of esoteric teachings, I would say, as the Gospel of Mary Magdalene. This one here. And that's also a very powerful gospel. Have you read anything of that?
No.
Gospel? This one especially, I think that would bear... I'll just read a little bit to show you what we've lost in Christianity. This is not the Christianity. How many of you have read this? Not most. Good. So this will be new to most of you. in relation to women, especially, and of Mary Magdalene. In this particular passage, this comes at a time when Mary has been telling the other disciples about her special encounter with Jesus, with Christ, with the risen Christ, who was risen not in a physical form, according to this gospel, but in a something that actually is more powerful than the physical form, the imaginal, or the nous, as it's called in Greek. And it gets into that doctrine too. And he gave her a special teaching, which he gave to no one else. And she's been telling the other disciples about that special teaching that he revealed to her. And it's at that point.
Happy about it.
Right. So it's at that point that, okay, here we are.
Can you tell us which part of the doctrine it is, page?
This one is not organized in logia like the Gospel of Thomas. It's organized in just pages, and a lot of them are missing, unfortunately. Here's where it starts. Having said all this, Mary became silent. For it was in silence that the teacher spoke to her. The teacher with a capital T is Jesus, how they refer to Yeshua, or Jesus. Then Andrew began to speak and said to his brothers, "Tell me, what do you think of these things that she has been telling us? As for me, I do not believe that the teacher would speak like this. These ideas are too different from those we have known." And Peter added, "How is it possible that the teacher talked in this manner with a woman about secrets of which we ourselves are ignorant? Must we change our customs and listen to this woman? Did he really choose her and prefer her to us?" Then Mary wept and answered him, "My brother Peter, what can you be thinking? Do you believe that this is just my own imagination, that I invented this vision? Or do you believe that I would lie about our teacher?" At this, Levi spoke up. "Peter, you have always been hot-tempered." There's a lot of other evidence for that, too, about Peter. "And now we see you repudiating a woman, just as our adversaries do." That's interesting. "We see you repudiating a woman, just as our adversaries do." So already, these early Christians held women and gave a place to women that was controversial. That's why they were adversaries. "Yet if the teacher held her worthy, who are you to reject her? Surely the teacher knew her very well, for he loved her more than us. Therefore, let us atone and become fully human, anthropos, so that the teacher can take root in us." Okay. Yeah. So that's a really different kind of Christianity. The Gospel of Thomas, let's see what time is it. It's already 8:30. My goodness, time really flies.
That reading touches on a theme that seems to occur in various of the Gnostic texts, and that is, it has to do with, I guess, the awakening of the the anthropos, or there's also language that would identify the light essence. Sophia is like the light vesture. And I don't know if you could, it seems to be kind of a begging question. What does that mean to, in the beginning of Gospel of Thomas, it says if you understand these readings, you will not die, essentially.
You'll see, actually it doesn't say you will not die. It says something more subtle than that. It says you will stop tasting death.
Yeah.
Because, and the way Leloup interprets that, and the way I follow him in that, is that it's not so much this thing you will not die in some metaphysical sense, but that you will sees, right now you are tasting death all the time. You're already dead. You're dying all the time. You will cease to die. But you will, and it might imply the other too. Some other, yeah.
It seems like that's almost what, you know, one of the, like a core teaching of the Gnostics is that we've really, I don't know, either mythologized or just overridden in the rise of Orthodoxy. But, you know, it's almost this...
in Orthodoxy it all happens after you physically die. And it happens through following the gospel and the priests and so on. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
You're going over all the different Gnostic gospels. Do you think there's a thread that there was, for better lack of a better word, like levels of initiation or levels of his telling based on a person's ability to receive the information? That he might have given more information.
Sure, all the time, Os echi ota aquin aqueto. Echi ota aquin aqueto. I've memorized that in Greek because I like the sound of the words. It means those who have ears, let them hear.
I quote that
it's over and over again.
He used that over and over again. So he wasn't trying to argue and convince people. He realized certain people just wouldn't get it.
Yeah, some people were right.
Mm-hmm. You said earlier that you were going to say some things about language and music and because I think a lot has to do with the problem of language and the ability of language to carry that which is always being said because the truth is always being said. The truth is life. So it's always being spoken, and somehow our language is seems not sufficient to carry that life thread, and just the insufficiency of language, and taking a deeper look at the language with which we are trying to instruct and to understand.
I think since ancient times, people have been aware of this limitation of language and tried to stretch it. Poets try to stretch it, and originally, of course, poets were musicians too. And the chants that we have, it's not enough just to read these texts. We need to chant them too. We need to get into the rhythm of it, and something to go beyond the usual limits of language.
Could we hear a chant?
Would you like to do some chanting?
Yes. See the drum.
Yeah, maybe. Okay. I'm just thinking what would work best. Would you like I got to think about time too, and it's 20 till. You want to do a longer chant that's a little more challenging, or a shorter one? That's what I'm wondering.
Shorter.
Shorter.
More
talk. Just look at my notes again. Make sure I got this exactly right. Greek is a beautiful language. That's another thing. The Gospels were originally written in Greek. The Jesus that I find credible, historically speaking, spoke Greek fluently. I can't believe that any educated rabbi and multicultural Galilee would not speak Greek. Everyone did. Everyone who... and even engaged in commerce, it was the language of even though it was the Roman Empire, it was because of the influence of Alexander, everybody spoke Greek, and I believe he also preached in Greek to people who couldn't understand it, his native language of Aramaic. In other words, I don't find the simple carpenter who spoke only Aramaic, I don't find that very credible. Anyway, this was Eki Utak, we not quite okay. That's Eki. Was Eki Ota? A queen?
That's okay, I'm just moving this a little bit so people can see.
Okay, let's just try, first of all, very slowly. Listen to me say it first, and then we'll say it together. Os ehi ota aquin aqueto.
Os ehi ota aquin aqueto.
And again, and savor the sound of the words.
Os ehi ota aquin aqueto.
I'll put the accents in so the rhythmic. Os ehi ota aquin aqueto.
So in modern Greek, it would actually be aqueto, but in ancient Greek, it would be aqueto.
This is Koine Greek. Koine. The biblical,
because modern Greek is very similar. I mean, the syntax is different. So I would have pronounced it akueto, but you're saying it's akueto.
You speak modern Greek?
Yes.
How would you pronounce it?
So I would pronounce that os ehi ota akuin akueto.
Mm-hmm.
With the accent.
You got a good subtlety of having a Greek here that we don't have.
Well, I'm just saying, for me, the accent was the only.
Acueto. What I hear is even accent. Acueto. Uh-huh. When you say it, I hear an even accent.
Okay.
Right?
Acueto. Yeah.
For the purposes of chant, I'm putting a little.
Thank you. Yeah.
That's probably all. Yeah. Acueto. Os ehi ota aquin aqueto. Os ehi ota aquin aqueto. I'll bring a little drum into it. And we'll have a nice Greek rhythm, five beat rhythm. Greeks love five.
What does that mean?
Whoever has ears.
You may not think you know how to do a five beat rhythm, but you do. Your body does it all the time. But Greeks really love this rhythm. Os ehi ota aquin aqueto. 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 That's really helpful with the drum.
Os ehi ota
try a bit of a little polyrhythm thing, which it's very natural. Should I tune this up? The first row here, just with me, and the rest silent for the moment. Just the first row only. I'll tell you what we're going to have to do. I'm kind of improvising here. Actually, let's do the first row, as I said, and then half of the second row, and including we need you. So we have a little more substance to it. And approximately half the group, okay? Oh, that helps a little bit to stretch the words, stretch the listening.
And the meaning was? The meaning.
Those who have ears, let them hear. Sorry, I should have said that. Yeah, so you knew what you were chanting.
You did say that. You did, which is what makes you.
If we were taught that words are sacred, or if we were taught from the start when we were children that words are sacred, I think we'd have a better chance of speaking what needs to be spoken.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a great, great loss that we aren't, that we don't know that deeply enough. You were saying that in the beginning, theater performance was sacred.
All the
performing arts were sacred, yeah. I mean, in the beginning, probably language was sacred.
Yeah, well, even going back not so far, poets were highly valued, considered indispensable to
bards.
Societies. Mm. Mm.
Do you think in the Gospel of Mary Magdalene that they touch into or allude into what the process might be in terms of supporting people in having the ears to hear and the eyes to see? Like, does she, in the understanding of the nose and, you know, the thing about the spirit and the levels and the layers and all that, is that, do you feel the opening or the portal that is trying to get some of that information that would assist people in having ears to hear and eyes to see?
There's certainly of course, you know, it's a process of evolution but everyone, we need all the resources we can find to evolve in that way, to hear more deeply, to listen, learn how to listen. But in that gospel, there's in the first part, there's. I don't think we have time to go into that. About the noose.
Yeah, because that's been my experience, that every time I open it, it's like all of a sudden I can see something that I never saw before. Mm-hmm. And so it's quite amazing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You subscribe that there's a vibrational attunement that is more than just our intellect. It's like a...
Did you have a question?
A statement, I guess, to be interested. I find that the chant and prayer that comes out of Teise to be very much that bridging of the ancient and the modern and the sacred, and that it really has spoken to me in terms of, you know, the chants, the use of Latin, the use of different prayer, repetitive prayer, some of this. I felt that they've been very creative in bringing forth that.
Are most people familiar with Teze? A movement started in France. So maybe you could. When are those? Could you remind me when that happens? It happens regularly at St. John's, right? In Petaluma.
It's the first Friday.
Sorry?
At St. John's, and the second Friday right here at St. Stephen's.
Oh, okay.
They had one last night.
It's a return to simplicity, and it's a return to it's getting out of this this terrible, to me, I hope I don't offend anyone by saying this, but this terrible 19th century body of hymns that Christians usually sing, that they're just musically so mediocre, getting away from that. You know. God's frozen people.
Well, I do, as a mystic and a Gnostic myself, many years of sitting in the forest and listening and years of writing and walking with other mystics, I could say that nature is the key.
Mm-hmm.
And sitting in nature, and I've taken many groups into the mountains, and it's amazing how people will just open up and words will come through, and starting from there. Mm-hmm. So I think each one of us has that. It's just being given the platform, the place in which to let it flow out.
Yes, I agree. I believe that's so essential, and it was in the original teachings of Jesus. It got lost. It really got lost. I remember hearing this fundamentalist preacher. He really amused me because he was really telling it like it is, because he was on a diatribe against pagans who were going and in his area, and he thought it was terrible. He didn't want to do anything about Lee. He realized live in a secular separation of church and state, so you can't make a law against it. He said, but he just wants to warn people against these pagans who go out in the woods and go out in nature. And he said, it sounds really nice. They go out in nature and go out in the woods and worship. But let me tell you, brothers and sisters, they're not just going out into nature and worshiping. They are worshiping the woods.
Very good. I've had that before. Yeah.
It's real. Yes. Nature is its own language. Nature is the language that we're searching for. That we're looking.
This book, As in the Heart, So in the Earth, beautiful book of that brings that. Mm-hmm.
There's a hymn that the hymn Hosea speaks directly to what you're talking about. Line, the wilderness will lead you to your heart where I will speak.
Would you say that a little louder, please?
The wilderness will lead you to your heart where I will speak. Mm. That's from Hosea. Mm.
Beautiful.
And it's one of those cold hymns.
Oh, you mean that's one of the 19th century hymns?
Yeah.
Well, the words are good, but I haven't heard the music. I'm not sure what the music is.
It's a beautiful hymn.
This is a whole different can of worms, but living in France, which is the home of postmodernism and continental philosophy,
right.
Has that had any effect on the religion of France? I mean, some postmodernists, in deconstructing modernism, were trying to kind of open up a space for the reemergence of the sacred.
The only instance of a real deep influence that I know of is Levinas, who's generally classed with the postmodern. I have a bit of a problem with this postmodernists, because and they don't like the term themselves. People who are called postmodernists don't like to be called that, mostly.
Right.
But I know what you mean, and along with Derrida and Baudrillard and all those guys. Levinas is less known, but he's it's not exactly my cup of tea, but it's an interesting attempt to bring deconstructive kinds of insights into especially Judaism and the Talmudic interpretations.
Okay. I don't know if you're aware of this, but there's been a movement in Western Christianity among the evangelicals, the much younger evangelicals, who were influenced by other, among other things, postmodern, and they're doing some very creative things and really getting away from fundamentalism and really recognizing, as you said, you know, that ultimately, when we speak of God, we're speaking, trying to speak of what cannot be spoken. Have you heard of any of that here? I'm just kidding.
Not really. As I was saying, that word postmodernism gives me a bit of a problem, because I don't see why you need to invoke that word to get away from fundamentalism. You know, why not just pluralism or openness of interpretation or ecumenism? Or I mean, we have lots of, because. Postmodernism to me often, not always, but often implies a kind of an absolute relativism, at which I really don't agree with at all. So that's a bit of a problem.
The term postmodernism to me creates isolationism, because it's very esoteric when people talk about it.
And mm-hmm.
and it creates more separation than inclusion.
I have to agree. Mm-hmm. But there's some people. There are some people classified as postmodernists who have some really interesting things to say. But they usually don't like to be called postmodernists.
Yeah, so.
I wouldn't either.
Well, I mean, what you seem to be doing reminds me of some of my friends who are in this movement.
Mm-hmm.
It's called by different names, the Emerging Church.
Yeah.
You know, they tend to be very creative and very artistic.
Could you give us some examples of that? Michael Beckwith?
No, I don't know Michael Beckwith.
No.
I have a friend in San Francisco.
No.
By the name of Mark Stanbrad. He runs an organization called Reimagine.
Mm-hmm.
And they have sort of a neat, what's called a neo-monastic flavor. They sort of form little tribes, and they actually take disciplinary vows. And mm-hmm. their idea is more living in the way of Jesus rather than, you know, seeing Jesus as... They want to live the religion of Jesus more than make religion about
right.
Jesus.
Right, exactly, yeah.
And, you know, he holds seminars on things like play and creativity, as well as, you know, taking on different disciplines.
Mm-hmm. That's really welcome news, yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, glad to hear that.
And I was just curious, is there anything like that going on in France?
Not that I know of.
Okay.
Unfortunately. Okay. Do you know me? No.
Alas, no. Cathars.
So how is the Catholic Church taking all this, bringing out of the Gospels, because they're coming out more and more, and people are looking at the books that were not included in the King James and such as that.
Well, as usual, the Catholic Church is really diverse and divided about it, but the power is totally against it.
Okay.
And I'll tell you an anecdote: is that we were hired to do a performance of what many of you saw from Jerusalem to Cordoba by a wonderful Catholic priest who was organizing a festival of sacred music, and it was an intro act for a more famous group. There were a lot of people. There were 2,000 people there, before we had to do some editing, and we couldn't sing everything. It had to be only 30 minutes, I think, in length. So we had to do some severe editing, but we did a full. He had heard a full version of it with the Gospel of Thomas, and he came to me, and he said, in a kind of embarrassed voice, he said, "You know, I love this performance of the Jerusalem to Cordoba, and I have no problem with the Gospel of Thomas, but tomorrow at that performance, the Archbishop will be there, and I know he'll hit the roof when he hears the Gospel of Thomas." And I said, "Well, as it turns out, we had to cut that part."
So he was so happy.
Yeah.
Amazing.
Yeah.
Little baby steps here.
Yeah.
Baby steps.
Well, you know, I've read a lot about Mary Magdalene being married to Jesus, being pregnant, and having a daughter, Sarah Tamar, who was born in Egypt. And they went to the south of France, and that in the south of France, Mary Magdalene was worshipped, the lady, and there was much in the Cathars. And so, is that all true? And is there still a kind of worship in the south of France? Because I have the impression, based on that.
Who knows? I don't know. I'd say there are fascinating French traditions about Mary Magdalene. And if you ever go to France, I really recommend it. It's one of the most powerful places I've ever been in, where supposedly Mary Magdalene has been her last place. It's called this has been really well worth a visit.
Is that the name of the town?
You have to.
Yeah.
Yeah. You have to go through the forest. If you Google it, you can find out. You have to walk. It's a strenuous walk through a forest, which, since ancient times, was sacred to Artemis, and that's the place she supposedly chose to finish her days. It's and you walk up to the grotto. And unfortunately, there's some kind of sentimental, awful Catholic religious art that they put in that grotto. But you kind of ignore that and just tune into the power of the place. Okay.
And then they say that she was, I'm hearing now from one of our girlfriends that she was actually stoned to death.
I've never heard that.
A lot
of stories.
I have not.
Prefer not to believe it.
Me too. Yeah.
So I guess I'll turn it over to Jim.
I will be happy to thank you so much for this wonderful performance. Thank you all for coming out tonight. I want to point out that we have a donation bowl on the counter. We share the proceeds that you generously give to us with our speaker to help his work. I also want to remind you that there are a slew of books that he has translated here, many of which he has referred to, a few of which he has not, which are lovely. There's some great ones, for instance, on the spiritual dynamic between Buddhism and Christianity, about other personalities like Alejandro Jodorowsky. And so there's a whole bunch of stuff here for you to take a look at. Thank you so much for coming out tonight, and we'll look forward to seeing you again at Many Rivers in the future. Thank you.
Thank you.
Sure. I'm happy to. Excuse me.
Sure. And I was thinking about that last question. I know on Roseman, Bishop Roseman's Gnostic website, those questions have come up so many times. And she sort of said she didn't think they needed to have marriage. What's her take on that?
Yeah. Yeah, I really don't know. It's an open question.
Yeah, there's a lot of things you don't know.
Yeah.
Thank you very much for coming to this festival again. Thank you for telling us how things are in France. I think we get these very ideas about where people are in the world, and we really don't know if we're living there.
Yeah, I didn't know how much I would talk about that, and I'm glad I didn't.
Yeah, I know, because when I went around, I was so naive. If there's anything that happens, you know,
So Jean Leloup, I say in Orthodox. This one I haven't read yet, but I read the one before. This one I got.
No, they are not yet inserts or pictures of keeping in the
I actually read up to I was walking into the house and reading and I got my house and said, can I take this?
I actually go to a church with Thomas Gideon, and he regularly tells a story that comes from one of the nine
Gospels.
It's a very
self-centered
thing. It's much more about preserving the virginity of Mary. It's just for sake of every Mary to Joseph.
It's all about working with the community. It's about reaching all the level of organization. And then everything is organized, you're less distracted. And so you can invite the truth in a clearer, purer way.
You could ask him if he gets wrong. He brought a whole box, but apparently that's where he went.
Oh, okay. I'll ask him. I'll ask him.
Let me ask Kathy. We have to save some of our best guys.
Well, if you are
feeling
if you are feeling
we can sell a few, but we can't sell all of these, actually. I don't think.
Here's a few.
Hold on just a second. But you have a sense we're in the bookstore. We have to consult with them. It's okay.
They aren't telling you that we're going to buy them.
Oh, okay. What?
$20
for it.
Here you go. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for coming and being so interesting. Years ago, I said I wanted to learn more about the Gnostics, and I remember writing down somebody said Christ is a faith in God. What's the book about Gnosticism? That's all I knew, and I never found it. So it's interesting that there's. I have heard of her.
Yes, you
that's
did.
That's the best selling one of these books.
I imagine on your website you have some of these books that are this bibliography. You have
That's right.
More like essay style.
Thank you for being
resourceful.
Thank you for being
resourceful. Someone said that they heard you through Hildegard von Bingen's on the radio or the internet or something.
I'm going to give you some very charged material.
Thank you.
I'm going to say something outrageous. I'm going to say something outrageous. In the Book of Revelation, you see the text from God. In chapter 5.
Oh, is that right? I don't know my Book of Revelation.
Okay,
well,
he receives the text.
Okay.
And that's my understanding that was his mission was to receive that text, and it couldn't happen until after he was crucified and ascended and goes to heaven. And that text is the blueprint for building heaven on earth. So it's chapter 5 in the Book of Revelation. You can go to it.
Enjoy. Thank you.
Yes, pleasure.
I loved your talk. Thank you so much. And I noticed on Amazon that Leloup had written a book on the therapeutic. It seems to be just in French.
Yeah.
Is it going to be translated? Are you going to translate it?
I hope
I'm
so.
An assumed teacher, and I want to see that information.
I hope so.
Yeah, maybe someday, huh?
Yeah, it all depends on the people at air conditioning.
Oh, I see. I'd love to see it in English. Thank you so much.
This is so enjoyable again. And I just got this book, and I noticed it says, you will live in vain and you will be vanity. Because some translations say you will live in poverty and you are that.
Yeah. I don't recall whether he give a reason why he chooses
no,
that. He often does when he diverges like that. Not at all.
Oh, I mean, to me that's so different. I actually really like
it. Yeah, I think the reason he doesn't like the word poverty, for that whatever the topic is that it seems to indicate there's something wrong with poverty, whereas other Christian teachings talk about the virtue of poverty, and so he thought vanity would be a better expression. It's not that different. It's not a radical divergence, I think.
And you're a poet.
But and some other places, there is a radical divergence. Sometimes he really diverges radically from other translators. I can't think of an example.
To me, that's kind of having an agenda about the
world. Well, you know, how do you act?